Greetings, everyone, and welcome. It's Naomi Wolf at Daily Cloud. I have with me Dr. Paul Alexander, with whom we've spoken before, former HHS official in the Trump administration and a researcher most recently with the Infectious Diseases Society of America. We have Dr. Peter McCulloch, very increasingly, you know, well-known outside of professional circles to the general public. Currently Vice Chief of Internal Medicine at the Baylor University Medical Center. And Dr. McCulloch has over 500 citations in the National Library of Medicine, which is also extraordinary. Dr. Howard Tenenbaum, Sinai Health, head of the Division of Research of the Department of Dentistry for Mount Sinai Hospital, specializes in infectious diseases. So this is the extraordinarily distinguished lineup, essentially, that we have with us. And I just want to greet and welcome all of you. Thank you so much. I'm rarely starstruck, but I'm actually kind of humbled and starstruck at such towering figures. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to start by, you know, each of you has your own specialization. Each of you has your own field of research. You are serving in different communities. And yet each of you has come to public attention for saying things about the pandemic and or about treatments recommended by our public health officials that are seen as in some way going against the prevailing discourse or recommendations. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but having said that, would each of you please speak to what you wish people understood about the coronavirus pandemic and about the push for one mode of treatment for everyone? And start with you, Dr. Tenenbaum.
Well, thanks for asking. I actually got involved very early on in the pandemic issue here in Toronto because of the work that we do here related to inflammatory diseases in the mouth. We have learned that there are a lot of sort of similar mechanisms and targets of treatment that we've identified in oral inflammatory disease that apply to COVID. And some of my colleagues in the States with whom I've done research with and ourselves have identified the fact that a well-known antibiotic, which is supposedly for bacterial disease, has many, many functions. And amongst those include its ability to stop the growth or replication of SARS virus or SARS-CoV-2, and also to prevent what ultimately really kills most patients, which is this unbridled inflammation or inflammatory cytokine storm that leads to destruction of lung tissue and things like that. And so really at the beginning of the pandemic, I approached several of my colleagues at the university and elsewhere with the idea that we look into the use of doxycycline, possibly in combination with other medications, including hydroxychloroquine, to manage and prevent death from SARS-CoV-2. And I was met with utter silence, if not rejection. The fastest way for me to end a conversation was to mention the word doxycycline and COVID in the same sentence. And this was typically with specialists in infectious disease, which I found really confusing. Yeah. And so I reached out to others, in particular, Peter McCullough, Harvey Risch, and said, you know, am I crazy? is this not an appropriate approach? And then became involved with this very august group of scientists and clinicians. And in fact, as it turns out, doxycycline, among others, including ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, are proving to be very useful in clinical trials. And it's sad because our institutions here could have been way ahead of the game had they just listened. But instead I was told that why would we do research on the basis of a theory? So I must have missed that lecture.
Can I jump in with a couple of follow-up questions, Dr. Tenenbaum? You know, just speaking as a lay person, no medical training at all. I am a mom, and my understanding is that, you know, the danger, one of the great dangers of SARS-CoV-2 is that it attacks the lungs. And, you know, you spoke about the cytokine storm, and often it's, you know, it's a respiratory disease, right? And I'm just talking as a layperson. So as the mother of a child with asthma, pneumonia is very dangerous to people with compromised lungs. When my child had asthma, we were given doxycycline, right, to address the infection in the lung and to keep it from getting worse and leading to the terrible things that can happen when you've got respiratory infections. Is this overly simplistic? Am I missing something? Why wouldn't anyone think doxycycline would be a helpful treatment for a serious severe respiratory infection? It's got a long history of that, right?
Right. In fact, I don't know. In fact, there are plenty of research papers describing the use of doxycycline for treatment of asthma or bronchitis. And so it makes a lot of sense, particularly when we understand the mechanisms of how it works, but I won't get into that. But it makes a ton of sense that this drug would, it has many effects. It's called pleiotropism. It has many different effects. And just because we call it an antibiotic and it does help kill bacteria, actually stops them from growing, doesn't mean that it doesn't do other things. Right. And we have plenty of drugs on the market that do more than one thing, and yet it was still rejected out of hand, completely ignored.
So bizarre. When you say rejected out of hand, silence, what does that look like? It's my understanding that physicians are allowed to, you know, choose what's best for their patient, right? That's why we stick with one doctor who knows our history. What did it sound like when your colleagues were acting like you're, you know, this is out of line, you're not going to pursue it, stop it now?
There are two sort of sounds. One I can mimic by turning off my microphone. That was one sound. And the other sound was almost a sort of derisive comments that they just couldn't understand why I would be promoting this approach at all. And my issue is that as a specialist in periodontology, I'm cross-pointed in medicine as well, but as a specialist in periodontology treating inflammatory diseases, I can't start a study on COVID on my own. You need medical colleagues. I eventually linked up with some, but we were not able to even get funding because there was no interest. And this was at another hospital. And so I needed the medical backup, which is really why I approached Peter and Harvey, Rish, because we needed somebody with the medical credentials to be able to help either design and or at least support the concept. So, I mean, we did an interview not too long ago, myself, Paul, and Dr. Rish, and I got an email from one of my infectious disease colleagues telling me that he was disgusted that I dared to talk about this alternate treatment, literally disgusted with me.
Extraordinary. And so did you finally treat COVID patients with doxycycline, and do you have any results of that hypothesis?
Well, as it happens, I can't really treat COVID myself, but at least officially, but I know of people that I've convinced, and they've been able to convince their MD who developed COVID-19, and they recovered almost within a day or two. And one of them in particular was definitely going downhill, ready for the hospital. And within a day or two, he was fine after administering a combination of ivermectin, in this case, and doxycycline. And one of our hospital dental residents went to India because her parents had COVID-19. They were in some sort of isolation unit and then sent home. Her mother was doing very poorly, not breathing well at all, but I sent with her some tablets of doxycycline. She put her mother on the doxycycline, and again, within 24 hours, her mother was fine.
Extraordinary. Heartbreaking. So, and yet so important. Lastly, my final question to you before we go on is, how would your colleagues have kind of gotten the memo that they're supposed to shut this down? Like, how, I'm really interested in group wisdom and taboos. And clearly, very quickly to me as an observer watching from the outside, very quickly in the scientific field and the medical field, certain taboos coalesced, right? And as a journalist, I usually think follow the money, but you know, medicine is very institutionalized and people would have to be kind of notified or signaled that something's off limits, that something's disgusting to raise, that nothing good will happen if you bring this up. How do you think your colleagues, and you may not know, you know, knew to have this reaction to what you were raising, which, you know, anyone with a sick patient is going to want to turn over every rock under ordinary circumstances to see if there's something that would help that patient. So what's your thought about that?
That's what you'd think, but it seems that they'd rather see people pass away then give them the appropriate drug. I can't understand it. And yeah, follow the money. I don't really think that there's a follow the money issue with the colleagues with whom I was dealing, because it was across the board, a complete a denial of the fact that there are actually medically viable ways to treat COVID-19. It's not a difficult disease to treat, and you'll hear more about that from Dr. McCullough and Dr. Alexander. But I don't think it was a money issue. It was just a across the board either rejection, overt rejection, or a sort of a roll of the eyes and saying no, that's ridiculous. And as I said before, that one of the a director of a research institute here literally said to me, that's a very interesting hypothesis, but why would anyone want to start a clinical trial on the basis of a hypothesis?
And isn't all good science? Doesn't all good science originate with?
Yeah, I'd say I must have missed that lecture when I was doing my PhD, because I thought that's why you do research, is to either disprove or prove a hypothesis. I couldn't believe what I heard.
Well, this is oddly making me feel better, because I've been hearing thoughtful, educated people in Western countries say things about scientific processes and medical processes that are pre-Enlightenment thinking. And that's one of them. We're back to as if the Enlightenment never happened, as if we don't have modern scientific processes, well, in which you ask questions.
In this regard, what I often say is that George Orwell was an optimist.
Yeah, really scary. And so is there any blowback you've had in addition to what you described, the kind of icy kind of expulsion from?
Certainly there, the interactions among staff here at the hospital is the type of interaction where if I send them an email now, I get no response at all. It doesn't matter what the topic is. I'm sure, I haven't checked, but I'm pretty sure I have a target on my back. And it's just, just complete denial, no conversation. And as I said, the fastest way to end a conversation, if I am having an email conversation with one of my colleagues, either in ICU, who tells me that, oh, we use remdesivir and maybe dexamethasone, but budesonide, which is another drug shown to be very effective, is going to be disallowed for treatment of COVID by the infectious disease specialists. There's just no answer. It's absolutely bizarre. But I don't think with this level of individual with whom I'm dealing, it's a money issue. It's like a mass hypnosis
That's right. And lastly, I promise. I mean, your system in Canada is what we would call a single payer system, right? There's private medicine out there, but most people get medical care for free. Are there penalties if doctors prescribe or treat a medical crisis in ways that the equivalent of the CDC or the equivalent of the AMA does not sanction? Like, is there a governing body that would discourage the use of alternative ways of treating? Well,
not so much from the single payer programs, which are, by the way, administered on a provincial basis, like a state. A state would administer its own public healthcare system. So that, pardon me, there's construction over my head. I knew they'd do this. So it's not necessarily the single payer, rather, it is the governing bodies, the licensing bodies,
right,
which have threatened to, and in some cases, I believe, taken medical licenses away, or at least suspended them, for daring to prescribe treatment that might save people's lives.
Extraordinary. So you're now confirming what we are hearing across the United States, and I've heard it from other physicians in Canada, that people are afraid of contradicting the governing body's dicta because their licenses could be revoked.
Right. One of the big champions in this area is Dr. Kulvinder Kaur, and she has been under direct attack by the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario for daring to say that lockdowns don't work, et cetera, et cetera, and that there is alternative therapy as in the type of treatment that you get from a shaman or something, but rather that there is effective early outpatient multi-drug therapy. And she has suffered tremendously, but she is very brave. And you should interview her.
Oh, absolutely. I used to follow her before I was deplatformed from Twitter for raising ordinary journalistic questions. So there are really courageous people out there. It's very terrifying, though, to think that this is happening, because this could be just the beginning, right? Like, any disease could be subject to some other agenda or some unspoken agenda, and people could be threatened with losing their licenses if certain treatments are given or withheld. Absolutely terrifying. Thank you so much, Dr. Tenenbaum. Welcome. I'm moving on to Dr. McCulloch. Thank you so much for making time for us. Can I put the same question to you? What do you wish everyone in, you're in the United States, what do you wish everyone in this country, all over North America, all over the world, but let's focus on the United States, knew about this pandemic and the singular directions we're being asked to treat it?
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. I'd want Americans to know that there's an inexplicable wave of therapeutic nihilism that's come over our government agencies, our medical centers, and actually the large body of doctors and nurses there. We've had the biggest medical emergency of our entire nation's lifetime, and our major medical institutions turn their backs on patients. Every single medical institution denied patients care, let them get progressively more ill until they couldn't breathe anymore, and then they got admitted to the hospital. We don't have the Harvard protocol, the Mayo protocol, Johns Hopkins. They didn't try to help a single patient. So what's happened is extraordinary. It is a dark cloud of therapeutic nihilism. There are hero doctors and hero people in government. We had two historic Senate hearings in November, December to break through to America that what Dr. Tenenbaum says is right. We can treat COVID-19 with multi-drug treatment. We've proven it in studies. We've published it in the literature, and we did it. Basically, what happened is the heroes band together in the United States. We formed four national telemedicine services, the most widely one known is myfreedoctor.com. It's free. And then 15 regional services, 500 treating doctors. We basically treated COVID-19, crushed our curves in January, put it down to a low. And I don't even think our federal officials and media even know about it, but the patients know. The patients know now that COVID-19 is treatable, and we've broken through. So all these different networks, it's really been an unbelievable historic story. I think historians are going to come back and say, wait a minute, you had an easily treatable problem, and that all these different powers crushed early treatment, promoted hospitalization, fear hospitalization, and death in order to prepare the population for mass vaccination. And then the mass vaccination program has come in and just been chapter two of really what is a medical disaster for our country.
Dr. McCulloch, I mean, what you're saying is absolutely historic. I mean, what each of you are saying is historic. This is 100% persuasive. I had a beloved friend who had, access to the best medical care money could buy, thoughtful, well-educated person, best doctors. She got COVID and she got sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. And I would call her for months and I would be like, what have they done for you? And she would say, I'm told to sleep sitting up, or I'm told to flip over and over. I mean, it was like Dickensian. It was like the way people used to be treated before there were modern medical treatments. And when you say something as simple as we're not treating people, we're letting them get sicker and sicker until they're hospitalized, it absolutely rings true. And you've gone ahead and actually organized a solution. So, you know, speak to this. Why did this happen? Like, this is so extraordinary. Why did these, why were people asked to get sicker and sicker?
I'd want the listeners to know the therapeutic nihilism doesn't stop at the hospital door. As we sit here right now, I am guiding a family that has a loved one, someone in their 70s, previously healthy. She's fighting for her life in the hospital. The family is begging for treatment, and they are begging for ivermectin, full dose low molecular heparin, full dose aspirin, and colchicine. They are begging for products that are available, proven in randomized trials, and they are given an absolute no by every doctor, the chief of staff, and the administrator. No. And these cases have gone on, and families have had to go to court and get court orders to tell them to treat the patients. So something is going on in the minds of doctors and hospitals right now that is so disturbing that just basic care. Now, the next patient next door who doesn't have COVID-19, they would negotiate drugs with the family all day long. But a COVID-19 patient almost by intent is railroaded to their demise.
I mean, it's like a conversation people might have had in 1932. You know, I mean, I believe you. And I've done enough reporting on the psychotic ways that death certificates are written in this country and in Britain to believe what you're saying. And I believe you. You're an extraordinarily credible person. You're dealing with people who are going through this. It's eyewitness accounts. What answers are the families given by the treating physicians for refusing things as basic as vitamin D, which is, I've seen the peer-reviewed studies. There's no question that it's helpful.
Right. So they won't administer nutraceuticals at all in the hospital, but they won't even administer things that we would accept to be acceptable in other cases. So, for instance, we know this is a blood clotting disorder. Right. You know, if there was a blood clot after a hip surgery, we would actually give full dose Lovenox. They're not doing it. If it was gout, we would give colchicine. Giving colchicine in COVID-19 in a prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial of 4,000 patients, the best clinical trial in all of COVID-19, colchicine reduces death and hospitalization. No light of day. Ivermectin, we have 60 supportive studies, works inpatient and outpatient. No light of day. The doctors are stonewalling the family. The administrators are stonewalling the family. This has happened countless times. It's happened in New York State, Illinois, recently in Louisiana. There's a hero attorney, Ralph Lorigo, who goes around the country getting court orders, forcing the doctors to treat patients. This is extraordinary.
I'm stunned. I mean, that's absolutely terrifying. I mean, that's like National Socialist level terrifying way to treat a medical emergency. So again, institutionally, something is going on, right? Like there's some sort of dissuasion, there's some sort of directive, and it's happening at a meta level, it would seem, because these are many different institutions. You mentioned many different states. How is that possible? Again, is it a protocol that if you violate it, you lose your license? Or what could be, I know I'm asking you to speculate politically or institutionally, and you're a healer, but what could make that happen? Like, I can't, you know, if you present with diabetes or you present with HIV or cancer, you know, you're not going to get this systematic denial of peer of treatments that have peer reviewed outcomes. So what could cause that? I have to ask you to speculate.
You know, I testified in the US Senate and I told America I was recovering from COVID-19 myself. So I looked terrible and I was holding up my protocol. And I told America, I said, listen, I am not asking permission to do this. I'm doing this. I want your help. I have treated all of my high-risk patients. It's not in my ethical or moral or clinical DNA to deny a treatment, a simple treatment like steroids. We give it for asthma, blood thinners, we give it for blood clots. I'm an internist and cardiologist. I do this stuff all day long. I would not suddenly shut off care to these patients. I have done a ton of work internationally. I'll tell you, it's worse in Canada. It's worse in the UK. In the northern EU, they're doing euthanasia. So they're not even treating the seniors. It's awful. And you go deep into the backwoods of Africa, South Africa, Philippines, Indonesia. It's going on worldwide. People are being denied treatment. There's therapeutic nihilism. There's great confusion among the doctors. I get desperate calls from young doctors saying, listen, we can treat this problem. But the senior doctors say no. Doctors have been threatened with being in jail in France, in South Africa, Australia, for using simple generic drugs.
Oh my God. So really, it's kind of pathogenocide. I mean, I don't mean to overstate it, but if you have a lot of people who are being denied care and the outcome is death or degradation, I mean, first of all these doctors are being forced to violate their Hippocratic Oath, right? Isn't it unlawful to deny appropriate care to a patient?
Well, from a civil perspective, it's called failure to treat. And, you know, when I was on with Tucker Carlson, he kind of reacted like you. He kind of really freaked out. And I said, listen, it's unethical, it's immoral. And from a clinical perspective, a civil perspective, it's illegal. But I have to tell you, this subversion is on a massive scale. Do you know hydroxychloroquine used to be over the counter in France? And as soon as COVID hit, they made a prescription, then they restricted it. Then they started to hit one of the early innovators, Didier Reault. He became incredibly uncomfortable in his institution. He couldn't maneuver. In Australia, before they even knew what was going on in April, they made it actually punishable by imprisonment if a doctor tried to help patient with hydroxychloroquine. Yet these countries stockpiled it. The second largest hydroxychloroquine manufacturer mysteriously burned down outside of Taipei. They were burning hydroxychloroquine across the pharmacies in Africa. This is a story for all time about the suppression of treatment in order to promote as much suffering, hospitalization, and death as possible. I think in preparation for mass vaccination, those two things seem incredibly tightly linked.
Well, it's certainly the case that all of the public health policies and governmental policies for the last 13 months, you know, have led to only one choice, which is mass vaccination with vaccines that are not yet FDA approved. I know that you've been deplatformed as well. Have you not, Dr. McCullough? Or,
you know, miraculously, I was deplatformed from Twitter for a lifetime suspension, and it only lasted 3 weeks. And by a miracle, I was restored. But I have to tell you, I haven't faced direct censorship. I have not had a single person look me in the eye and tell me I was wrong. And the doctors that I deal with who have, in a sense, they're confused, their minds are confused, and they're in this wave of therapeutic nihilism, not a single one has had the courage to say a single word. It's almost as if they're doing a walk of shame.
Yeah.
Walk of shame. You know, Steve Kirsch, the flamboyant millionaire, he has offered a $2 million prize for anybody who can find anything that the CDC, NIH or FDA has done correctly in the pandemic. Anything. He'll pay $2 million. Not a single thing. So every decision that those agencies made, every single decision was actually wrong. It actually made things worse.
So you're saying professionally you have not had blowback. And I know that you're in a state, you're in Texas, right?
Right. Well, in my institution, my contract was not renewed. And that's the choice of Health Texas Provider Network. So I'm no longer the vice chair of medicine at Baylor, but I move my patients over to a practice. I'm still in the same complex. I still see patients every day. So it's not as if I didn't feel professional pressure, but I don't have a single person who can make the case that the best thing to do is to let people suffer at home and die. How can you make that case, right? Yeah. They don't have a case to be made. So I think there's just so much tension in the medical community now. We have 620,000 Americans who died. We now believe 85% of them could have been saved. We were scheduled to actually lose 1.7 to 2.1 million Americans, according to CDC. The hero doctors cut it short at 620, but still that's too many. And I think in the end, there is going to be such a thorough wave of investigation from all the agency levels, all the different institutions. How come they couldn't treat a single patient? What went wrong? Let's do a deep dive on what went wrong. This global loss of medical capacity, this global wave of intentional therapeutic nihilism that was so injurious and really deadly to patients all across the world.
I mean, what you're describing, you know, is so massively nefarious and
I'll give you one more anecdote, and I want to turn it over to Paul Alexander. But I'm the most published person in my field in the world in history, so I'm kind of a big deal. I'm an editor of two major journals. I'm a household name. People kind of know who I am. 2 years ago, I was the endowed lecturer at Harvard School of Medicine. I gave lectures across departments. I was celebrated. I met with all different types of officials. That would be a usual thing for me. This year at a different Ivy League school, I was asked to deliver a lecture, but it was going to be by Zoom. I said, my topic is going to be the early treatment of COVID-19. I went through all the vetting, the slides, conflict of interest, contracts, all this other stuff. The night before the lecture, I got a panic call from the institution. Said, Dr. McCullough, we cannot allow you to give this lecture. I said, why? It's all scientific data. It's all peer-reviewed. It's all vetted. So I said, why not? They said, our infectious disease division all went to the chief of medicine, and they protested, and they said, we cannot let Dr. McCullough deliver that message to young doctors. Can you imagine that?
Yes. I mean, I can only because I think each of us and many other distinguished, thoughtful people that I know in different fields are facing very similar kinds of institutional ostracism in a very unilateral.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is they were afraid of the message. Right. The message is this is a treatable illness and here's the methods by which we treat it. They were afraid of the method. It's their fear that's the problem. They were afraid. They were basically afraid of the truth. Right. And that is what we're going to have now with the suppression of early treatment and vaccine safety. It's fear of the truth.
Yeah. Do you think that fear of the truth, you mentioned investigations, and I think that's right. I think that's inevitable. People forget that just because I'm a Democrat, but people forget that just because one party's in power, it doesn't mean they'll always be in power. And someday every stone will be unearthed about this. The way they were, you know, with the Nazi doctors. And I'm Jewish, I'm the granddaughter of people who lost siblings in the Holocaust. I know that that's seen as a sensitive analogy, but if you look at the dawn of Nazi medicine, it was virtually identical to this. You know, life unworthy of life. These people can't, you know, should be marked as don't resuscitate, you know, don't treat, send them off, give them half rations, let them perish, etc. And then it just metastasized. So having said that, would the fear of the truth also be a fear of guilt for what's happened in the past? Like, why else would you say, don't let these scientific facts be heard? What would cause that?
Well, I think initially fear of the truth early on meant actually potentially being exposed to the virus. So I think actually doctors were very afraid of getting the virus themselves. But once they got months into denying people treatment and we saw this wave of mortality and hospitalizations, they basically became complicit or compulsive. You know, they became part of the problem. And now we basically have a massive wave of malpractice. These malpractice cases are going to go on for decades now. I tell you, every patient who died, they made desperate calls to their doctors begging for treatment. You know, we even have monoclonal antibodies that are EUA approved. US purchased 500 million doses. They sit on the shelves. We won't give patients any access to these. I testified in the Texas Senate. I said, get a 1-800 number so grandma can figure out how to get an antibody infusion. And you know, legislation was written a day later. And then 2 weeks later, the Texas Medical Association said, no, we're not supporting that. We want to replace that with a vaccine registry. So there is suppression even of the finest emergency use authorization products. You never see these antibodies given any light of day on TV. TV has been a railroad of vaccination. And remember, the acutely sick people are still going on. The vaccine is failing. So the vaccine recipients are getting COVID. They still need antibody infusions, but there still is, this is a one-way street. There's only one approach here, and it's a needle in every arm.
Extraordinary. All right, so my last question. I know, because I heard you in an interview addressing the vaccines and the side effects from the vaccines, and you wondered about a reduction in population agenda. Am I misquoting you or misremembering?
Well, the vaccines right now are doing more harm than good. I think it's clear. I'm not the only one. I mean, there are calls from the leading doctors in the world very early on to say, get these things off the market. They're very, very novel genetic technologies. They're causing all different things to happen to the human body. They're not even preventing COVID. I mean, it's really been a catastrophe. So we have citizens' petitions in from doctors and nurses to the FDA, don't approve the products. We have evidence-based consulting group in England, who's a principal contract consultant to WHO, has officially told the MHRA in England, they're not fit for human use, pull them down. We have a paper from Bruno, you know, 57 countries, not safe. You know, they don't even have a data safety monitoring board. We're 6 months into this. There's not been a single press briefing on overall safety. We have 9,000 Americans who have died, 50% of them within 48 hours, 80% of them within a week, 86% of them by independent review are directly due to the vaccine. 9,000 dead Americans and it's still going strong. Hundreds of thousands of safety reports. I mean, this is not anywhere close to being safe. And now the Delta virus is just blowing past the vaccine like it's nothing. 42% of all the Delta cases that are sick in England have been vaccinated. So it's obvious it doesn't work. So I have to tell you, things are coming to a head. This is a rapidly moving story and your efforts, I think, are well placed.
Thank you so much. So I promise this is the last question. Do you have a why? Like, this is malfeasance on such a gross scale. You know, it's easy to say one industry or another is benefiting, but the metaphysics and the meta organization of what you're describing, what you all are describing, is it's such a kind of massive scale. It would take coordination at such a high level. Do you have a why when you look around you at this psychotic behavior?
Well, I can tell you, if it was a memo, I must have missed it. But it's actually in the minds of everyone. You think out of all the broadcasters, 4,000 broadcasters in the United States, why wouldn't one of them have basically a little update on early treatment? It's actually in the minds of everyone. I've had people reach out to me from all over the world, and I can tell you, there are young doctors who can sense something is wrong in the most remote places in the world. And I'll ask them, do you know who, you know, Bill Gates is? Or do you know who Pfizer? They said, no. Do you know who Trump is? No. Do you know what, Fauci is? No. So I'm telling you, it's in the minds of people and it's independent of all these stakeholders that you're thinking of. It's something very, very global.
All right. All right. So thank you so, so much. So now I'm going to go to Dr. Alexander, and we had the pleasure of speaking before, and your interview with me is being very well received. Just please chime in. You know, what did you want people to know that that they don't know about this pandemic and, of course, the treatments?
Thank you very much. And it's very hard to follow Dr. Tenenbaum and Dr. McCullough. Oh, my God. Listen. You mentioned that you're a Democrat, and I want to be focused here by saying this off the top. You know, when we talk as our own research groups, it's not about the politics. And I mean, look, it's well known. I had a short stint in the Trump administration, but if the Biden administration today asked me to provide some technical input and help, I would gladly serve. Who would not serve an administration and a president? It's not about politics for someone like myself. It's the science. Now, the reality about it is, I want to go on record and say that I am against the vaccines, particularly for children. I think under no condition, based on what we know, based on how these trials were done, that any child should be given any of these vaccines today. And the reality about it, Naomi, is we knew very early on that this condition, COVID, was amenable. Very amenable to risk stratification of your baseline risks. So that we knew very early on how to manage this. We knew who the high-risk groups were. We knew how to treat it. And I mean, it is a devastating shame that we had early treatments very early on that we could have treated people. And the way Dr. McCullough and Dr. Tenenbaum explained it, here's the key question that Americans need to ask themselves. How could you tell me that someone who is high risk, and let's say elderly, or even severely obese, or even a young person who has underlying grave medical conditions, that you are infected and you begin initial symptoms, how could you say as a doctor that you would send them home for that 10 to 12 to 2 week window, where that is a perfect window,
right,
where we know if we get in there with antiviral treatments, right, at that point we could arrest the virus and we could stop you from moving along to the very severe sequelae where the acute respiratory distress, the florid pneumonia phase. I would use the word crime here, because this particular virus, we have an actual very perfect window that we could step in. And you are doctors' hands are off. People are sent home to wait and see, and they worsen in place, and they begin to die. I've learned from our statistics that I've read that once you get into the hospital setting, for a 28 to 30 day mortality, you're at about 38 to 40% increased risk of death. Why would you then want someone to enter the hospital when you could begin saving their lives as an outpatient in the private home or in the nursing home?
You're absolutely right. And hearing it, you know, versions of this from a panel of such distinguished healers from different places and experiences makes it absolutely clear that a massive crime has been committed. Well, you talked in our last conversation about the blowback so that you've experienced. So I guess yes. I'd like to wrap up because you've all been very, very generous with your time. I mean, each of you is a hero in my view, and you're in touch with heroes. Okay, you can say no, but in my experience, people who really do heroic things always say it was just my job, right? Or there was nothing else to be done. So I'm not flattering you. I'm actually asking, at a time like this, you know, each of you has faced blowback from your colleagues, you know, loss of position, or you've had to recreate your professional lives, you've had to endure, you know, isolation institutionally or other things, and you're still telling the truth. Like, you got on this call to tell the truth about the biggest crime in living history, you know, from what you're all describing, no question about it. I wanna ask where people like you draw the courage to do that? Just a characterological question. Where does it come from? How do you do that?
That to me?
Yeah, let's start with you. And then we'll
okay.
go.
So I'll say this. I think every human being must have a line of integrity that you just won't cross over. And I have my own particular line. And I myself have experienced a lot of blowback. Recently, I found out that my position at McMaster was not being renewed. Sorry. And you know, people on the inside have came to me because I've made my own friends over the years and very good friends. And they've said, you know, Paul, partly it's because of your prior work with Trump. You know, it was just this anti-Trump rabid view. And also because you're very outspoken on early outpatient treatment and you've been writing so much. So that is something now I have to eat and accept. But the reality about it is in Canada and United States, there are very, very good people like Dr. Francis Christian, Dr. Hoff, Dr. Kulvinder Gill, that Dr. Tenenbaum has mentioned. He himself is getting it in his workplace. Every way you turn, you're getting it, because the reality about it, Dr. Wolf, is that we are on the right side of history. I have no question about that. And we are actually dealing with the science. The other side is not. And as Dr. McCullough has said, you know, in the future, we're going to have we need to have a proper examination of what really went wrong here, because it actually makes no sense. Something other than science is at play here.
Right. Thank you so much. If you don't mind, Dr. Tenenbaum, can I ask you, where do you draw the reserves? You know, people watching will be thinking, I would like to live like that. I'd like to be that strong. I'd like to be that brave. Where do you draw the reserves for that?
I looked at it from the perspective of I had no choice. We just have no choice but to speak up. Friends of mine would say, why are you bothering? You're just gonna, you know, be criticized, and it's not gonna work. What your advice, your interviews, it's not gonna work. And my answer to them is that, first of all, I believe that we're more morally and ethically bound to push this. And secondly, I tell them, you know, there's very few things that one can guarantee. I said, but I can guarantee that there will be no change in the way we manage this virus and future viruses if we don't speak up now. I can guarantee that. I can't guarantee that there will be change if we speak up, but I can certainly guarantee the other. And I think really, when you look at it, it's not even a matter of following the money. I think when you look at the governmental responses to this, they know that if they change course, if they don't lock us down again when the next, let's say during flu season, that this will be a tacit sort of admission of a seriously flawed a pandemic response. And that's an admission of guilt. And so these politicians of ours, I don't call them leaders. We don't have very many leaders anymore. And these politicians, what's their biggest worry? They want to get reelected. Well, you know, if the premier of Ontario, which would be like a governor, performs all these lockdowns as everyone tells him to do, and if people still die, well, the electorate will say, well, he tried.
Right.
He tried, but, you know, it just didn't work. On the other hand, if he were to say, you know what, these lockdowns were a mistake, we made a mistake, and school closures were a mistake, and so on and so forth, you can bet that he's going to have to face the music then as to why did you do this in the first place, and he might not get, in fact, probably won't get elected and could even face, who knows, criminal charges. I really think that's at the base of it. I think there are extant and external forces that are leading everyone to act in the same way. I don't necessarily think that everyone's receiving brown envelopes stuffed with cash so that they don't do the right thing. But when there are certain forces at play, then everyone acts in the same way.
That's right.
And that's, I think, the worst example of the fact that we have no leadership anymore. Right. We have politicians.
Understood. Thank you for that eloquent response as well. And Dr. McCullough, where do you draw your courage and strength from day to day?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm so proud of Dr. Alexander and Tannenbaum. We really have galvanized worldwide. We are working with key groups, C19 in America, FLCC, Heart and Bird in the UK, Panda out of South Africa, now worldwide, Treatment Domiciliary in Italy, and COVID Medical Network in Australia. There are doctors whose eyes are clear and their hearts are not hardened. And I can tell you with every single ethical, moral, and clinical fiber of my body, it is the right thing to do to try to help a patient with simple drugs survive a potentially fatal illness. I know I'm not wrong. And on the other side, when we have a brand new therapy and brand new technology that's injected into half of Americans, and we've seen 9,000 Americans die, 400,000 injured, I can't stand on the sidelines and just, you know, be silent. I can tell you something very, very wrong is going on. It may have been started years before, but it's clearly wrong. And I think the vaccine is just one chapter in the story. I think we're in for about 3 to 5 years of hard work. This is a giant struggle of morality, of what's right and wrong, good and evil. You can see it all over the world. And honestly, I'm like Paul and Howard, we're on the right team. We're on the right side.
Well, this is a riveting and historically important conversation. You've all been so generous. I want to ask finally, how can everyone watching help you with these efforts that you've described? All of you are working together to raise awareness, to help save patients. Where do people go to send money, send resources, send supports, and media attention? How do they help?
Well, I'll start. There's a wonderful organization called Truth for Health. It's led by Dr. Lee Vliet, Dr. Lee for America and America Out Loud. That is a charitable organization. MyFreeDoctor.com, led by Ben Marble. That's a free medical service that provides medicines and care to patients all over the country. They work by donations. Those are wonderful places for philanthropy. I have my own radio show on America Out Loud, The McCullough Report, where I cite in the literature, and I have the world's most expert guests. And we have the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, aapsonline.org, that has a COVID or home patient treatment guide and a tremendous number of resources. And we're all here to try to help everybody the best we can.
Fantastic. So everyone race to support all these organizations that Dr. McCullough just described. Send money, send resources, and everything you can. And Dr. Alexander, how can people help you in your efforts?
Well, I mean, the same with Dr. McCullough, those organizations that he named, we're all part of it in different ways. Truth for Health with Dr. Vliet, et cetera. So I would echo the same ones that he named. And we are doing a lot of interviews and writing. You know, we're on AIER, we're on Trial Site, especially LifeSite News, et cetera. So if you Google any of our names, you would find our articles. And we are just taking the opportunity to unpack the issues and explain.
Absolutely. And people can also help you, I assume, by sharing your article.
Yes, you can share this interview.
Exactly.
With an open mind.
Absolutely beautiful. And Dr. Tenenbaum, how can people help you with your efforts?
Well, I think in Canada, I think one of the most important things is to bombard members of provincial parliament, which would be like states, legislatures, and the members of parliament, which would be similar to the federal Congress and so on in the United States, and speak to them and show them these types of interviews. Sadly, though, that certain members of parliament who have spoken up about this are also being marginalized, kicked out of party caucus, which means that they're now independents. They're not necessarily part of a political party, but there has to be public outrage and public outcry. And sadly, I think that until we start to see, or if we see deaths starting to occur in young individuals at an alarming rate, which is already there anyway, but if we start to notice it and it starts to make it into the mainstream media, I think that mothers and parents are probably going to be the most forceful group against whom they are going to be faced. And those are the people that have to call for the changes, because if they don't, we can talk till we're blue in the face. I think speaking to members of the medical profession, as important as it might seem, is just not going to work. It's very classic. People are more willing to be fooled than to admit that they're being fooled.
Completely well said. And so everyone, I agree with you, moms and dads who are furious are a powerful force. Everyone can be outraged, and that too will help get us out of the wrong side of history. Dr. Tenenbaum, Dr. Alexander, Dr. McCulloch, again, I'm beyond grateful and honored to have had this time with you. I know that I hope hundreds of thousands of people will be enlightened by what you just shared. And I hope you get waves of support and continue to for your heroic efforts to really save humanity. There's no simpler way to put it. Thank you all from my heart. And this is Naomi Wolf with Daily Clap. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, you guys.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Good luck.